And in his teaching, he said, "Beware of the scribes who like to walk around in long robes and light greetings in the marketplaces, and have the best seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at feasts, who devour widows' houses and for pretense make long prayers. They will receive the greater condemnation." And he sat down opposite the treasury and watched the people putting money into the offering box. Many rich people put in large sums, and a poor widow came and put in two small copper coins, which make a penny. And he called his disciples to him and said to them, "Truly, I say to you, this poor widow has put in more than all those who are contributing to the offering box. For they all contributed out of their abundance, but she, out of her poverty, has put in everything she had, all she had to live on."
On May 14th of 2020 is when I think my life peaked without me realizing it. I started going downhill from there. Maybe you realized it, but I did not realize it. On May 14th of 2020, I was working as an intern here at the church. Actually might have been resident full-time here, kind of working with our student ministries. And as I was working with our student ministries, I was working alongside Pastor Greg, who's over at our County Line campus, Pastor Joel, who's at our Barberton campus, and one of my dear friends who has kind of moved away from here. And so we were working together in the midst of 2020, which if you're familiar, that was the year of COVID. And so we were trying to figure out what in the world do we do? Nobody knows what to do. So we thought, you know what? What better way to spend our 2020 than on TikTok? So we got on TikTok, created an account for student ministries. We thought, you know what, let's share some videos for students to enjoy, to put a smile on their face, right? Nothing fancy, nothing crazy, but we did this video, we recorded it, had no idea that it was about to be a video that was going to make us great in a lot of ways, because this video, first day we posted it, got a couple hundred views. That was like great. That was more than we ever anticipated or could have imagined. The next day it got a couple thousand views. The day after that it got 1 million views. The day after that it got 4 million eyeballs on that thing. And so you've probably seen it. I know you have, all right? I know you're thinking about it. You already know it. But I want, in case you haven't seen it, to check this out.
It's a quarter after one. Said I wouldn't call, but I lost all control.
15 seconds. I'm not sure why you're clapping, but 15 seconds of greatness in that moment. 15 seconds here like that and gone just as fast. We thought to ourselves, man, that was awesome, but had no idea what that was going to do. Later, we had America's Got Talent reach out to us asking, and a true story, I'm not kidding. They reached out to us asking if we would be interested in auditioning for their show after hearing us sing. People in the comments were furious at us because if you didn't know this, that's not actually us singing. I would be leading you in worship, right? Like, come on. I mean, that was awesome. But it was us lip syncing to that song. But people in the comments are going back and forth. It's, if you want a good time this afternoon, go find that video. Look at the comments because it's a good time when people are getting furious at each other. We didn't bamboozle the world on purpose. We were just having fun. And so we went out there and we're like, man, that was pretty cool. Let's see if we can do it again. So we did another video. We got them here. No, I'm just kidding. The second video did not go as well. And the third video went even worse. But there was something in us, something in my heart, I don't know about your heart, but 4 million people got their eyeballs on it, and we're all of a sudden like, man, I think we made it, right? Like there's something that burns inside my heart of greatness that wants to be great. And I thought to myself, let's try and do it again. Our world seems infatuated with greatness these days. Our world's infatuated with it. Our current president ran on the slogan, "Make America Great Again." Not make America good again, make it great. John Lennon claimed in 1966 that the Beatles were the, quote, more popular than Jesus. You didn't learn in history class about Alexander the Average. You learned about Alexander what? The Great. The Great. We're obsessed with greatness. We desire greatness. We seek to do great things. We seek to have great things. We seek to experience great things. And did you know that you could spend your life doing great things and not be all that great? You can spend your life seeking after to having and obtaining great toys on this planet and not be all that great. And you can spend your days experiencing all the greatness this world has to offer and still not be all that great. We define achievement, greatness based on achievement in our world today. We define it on beating out the competition. Whoever has the most impressive resume is the greatest among us. And we live in a world that makes seeking after greatness normalized and expected. In fact, we teach our young that it's a virtue to be great, which adds this kind of pressure that we feel when we're young, right? That we want to get the grade, we want to hit the ball, we want to make the tackle, get the lead part, we want to be a high performer. And you ask the dream for Gen Z, what's the dream? What's the goal? 57% of Gen Z will say to be an influencer, to be a YouTube content creator, to be a star in their own podcast, to curate and craft a social media platform that throws out their greatness into the world, trying to prove how great we are. We struggle for greatness, and this struggle for greatness has not been a recent phenomenon. This is one all throughout history, as old as time. Adam and Eve struggled with greatness when they chose to take the fruit, hoping that they'd become great. Cain struggled with greatness and Abel, causing him to murder him. The pharaohs of old built things to show their greatness, and in Jesus' day, greatness was still a struggle. Jesus lived in a Roman culture, and the Roman world had a vision for what greatness looked like. Caesar Augustus primarily led the way. Isn't he great? Look at him. He looks great right there. Caesar Augustus, in case you didn't know this about him, he was the first Roman emperor who reigned 45 years. His kingdom was pretty great and impressive. He was ruling during the birth of Christ. His name was not actually Caesar Augustus. His name was Gaius Octavius. Gaius Octavius, which Gaius means this. It simply means happy or rejoiced. And Octavius is where we get the word eighth place, right? So he was happy that he's eighth. He didn't like that name very much. I don't think I would either. And so he decided to change his name to Augustus. Augustus, which means this, exalted one or majestic. A nickname for him would have been the Increaser. The Increaser. How would you like that as a nickname? He was greatness. He defined his name. He claimed to be a god. He was the Senate later declared him as a god after he died. But he wasn't the only leader of the day in Roman world. There was another leader that you're maybe familiar with, Herod the Great. He was appointed by Rome, the Senate of Rome, as king of the Jews. Herod executed these massive building projects to bring prosperity into his kingdom. He built a magnificent palace on a man-made mountain called the Herodium. And it was a palace to just kind of show the world. He just threw a bunch of dirt, plopped a palace on it, and said, "This is my greatness that I want to show you." He was a paranoid leader seeking after greatness and afraid that he might lose it at any second. In fact, he is the leader that when Jesus was born, he decided to do a mass slaughtering of all two years of age and under Jewish boys because he had heard rumors of a greater king that was coming after him. He was paranoid about his greatness. Greatness in the Roman world was all about domination, control, and raw power. But the Romans didn't just struggle with greatness. The Jews struggled with greatness as well. The Jews, they looked at greatness a little bit differently, but they had a vision of greatness that was about moral upkeep and law observing and clean living and living respectably among their peers. And in the context of Mark 12, where you're at in your Bible, where we're going to spend the bulk of our time today, is Jesus is in the temple of Jerusalem getting ready for Passover. Passover, at that time, is like the biggest Jewish holiday. They're getting ready to be reminded of God's mercy and faithfulness, of them coming out of Egypt, celebrating this all together. And if I could take you back 2,000 years and have you walk the streets of Jerusalem during the time of Passover celebration, what you would find is Jerusalem looks very different than what it would normally look like. It was all cleaned up. It was all cleared out. The things were, the old paint was stripped down. The new paint was put on the tombs to make them whitewashed and beautiful, to make the whole city look prestigious and clean and fresh, because there was about to be a life in commotion as hundreds of thousands of people come piling in to the city of Jerusalem to celebrate and to seek after God during Passover. And it's at this point where Jesus is like, I think I should ramp it up on my like warnings about the Roman leaders and religious leaders. I think in the temple of God with all these guys working is when I should call him out a little bit, right? Not the place I would have done it, but that's the place he decides to do it. And let me just tell you, give you a forewarning, they were fuming at it. Because he went right up against their vision of greatness. And Mark 12 says this, that they sent some of the Pharisees and the Herodians to Jesus to catch him in his words. The Pharisees and the Herodians, the Pharisees were the religious conservatives of the day. The Herodians were the political party that promoted Rome and the family line of Herod, having Herod be kind of the vision for the good life. The Pharisees and the Herodians do not get along, but they get in bed together, so to speak, and they start peppering Jesus with questions, trying to trap Jesus. Which, as you can imagine, if you try and set a trap for God, doesn't work that great. And it didn't work that great for them. They set him up by trying to ask him about taxes and politics and resurrection and theology and authority and commandments and the law. And both of them hated Jesus because Jesus was disrupting their vision of what greatness was supposed to look like. For both groups, greatness was all about climbing to the top. It's all about climbing to the top. The Herodians and the political world, if we can climb to the top or put the right people in the top, then we'll all rise together. For the Pharisees, it's the religious world. If we can climb our way to the top, but Jesus saw right through both these groups' hearts. And he saw, man, you guys are way more similar than you even realize. And Jesus would say things to his disciples like this in Mark 10. He says, you know, that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. Worldly greatness is just this preoccupation with promoting the self. It's a preoccupation with promoting the self. It's lifting the self up higher and higher, moving through the ranks, jumping up the levels, climbing the ladder, to make yourself look super, super impressive. And as they're asking Jesus all these questions, trying to get him trapped because they're frustrated with him, it says literally, go read it, Mark 12, it says no one dared ask him any more questions. They're like, we're done. Jesus has got too much verbal jujitsu going on that he just pins it back on us. We're done asking this guy questions. But then Mark 12, verse 37 says this, the large crowd listened to Jesus with delight. The KJV says it this way, and if you look in the Greek, this is a good translation of it. Not just the large crowd, but common people. Common people. Not the wealthy, not the leaders, not the Romans, not the Jews, Jewish like religious leaders. Just the common folk are listening to Jesus, and they're delighted to hear him. The Pharisees are frustrated, but the common folk are ready. They're intrigued. They want to know. And look at what Jesus says to the common folk. He says to them as he taught, he says, watch out for the teachers of the law. Where is he saying this? In the temple. In the temple. I mean, Jesus has got some guts, man. Like, Jesus is in the temple, and he's talking about the religious leaders, and he says, watch out for these teachers of the law. And they're probably standing right there in front of him in earshot. And he says, they like to walk around in their flowing robes to be greeted with respect in the marketplaces and have most important seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at banquets. And Jesus is saying, watch out for them. Don't watch out for the addicted, the sick, the hurt, the broken, the messy ones, but watch out for those who are in the religious system. Some of you need to hear this today. Jesus saves his most compassionate, gracious, kind words to those whose lives are in shambles, who can't get it together, who are messy, who feel like they shouldn't be here. Some of you need to know that today. Jesus has got a really good word for you. And those of you that come every week, Jesus... Those of us that are like religious, Jesus reserves some of his most harshest, punchiest, sting-filled words for you and me of warning. It's like Jesus spends most of his time warning about the religious insiders and much of his time blessing and inviting the religious outsiders. And often in the church, if we're not careful, we get it flipped, don't we? Where we start blessing the religious insiders, and we start warning against the outsiders. But Jesus is totally different. And I'll be honest, I was reading this week, and this made me quite uncomfortable. Because it's not quite the same as saying this, but it's not too far of a stretch to go, watch out for pastors, Bible teachers, and group leaders around you. And I'm the pastor of biblical community and groups here. And I don't know, you can imagine how my week was prepping for this. I'm like, oh, well, I'm going to talk to him about watching out for me or people in positions like mine. What's he say to watch out for? He says, watch out, beware of one, their flowing robes. Their flowing robes, that they were these fashionable robes that they would strut their stuff with, that they were robes of privilege and elitism. They weren't like robes that you wear roofing, right? Like you're not on a roof wearing your robes. I don't know if there's robes like that, but they're not those. They're not blue collar robes. There are robes based on appearance, because appearance mattered tremendously to these guys. They wanted to have the image, the external look, the brand, the curated fashion, so that you would be able to see their appearance and go, wow, look at them, right? Second thing Jesus warns about is they like to be greeted with respect. They like to be called rabbi. Rabbi would literally mean great one. So these guys would like to go walk around not just the synagogue, not just around church. They want to walk around the marketplace. They want to be seen out in public at the grocery store and have people come up to them and go, oh, great one. Oh, rabbi, pastor. This is why I love you. Some of you really like calling us on staff pastors. Like, if you feel comfortable with that, that's fine. I don't prefer it. I'm just Ethan. Like, and I think all our pastors agree with that. Like, we're just normal dudes. But some like to be greeted with respect, oh great one, in the marketplace, as if they're spotted and looked at as this celebrity, as if they're really something, because not only appearance mattered to them, recognition mattered to them, to be seen, to draw the attention of others, to have fame. But thirdly, Jesus says they like important seats and places of honor. There would be a place where they would come in the temple and sit. It was known as the Torah box. It was on a bench, and they would sit. And as people were funneling into the temple, they would be seen. They would see everybody kind of coming in. But more importantly, everybody would see them on their way in. They would assume every meal that you had, you would want them to sit in the place of honor. If they were showing up at your wedding, they would assume that they didn't need to look at the guest list or the table number. They would just assume that I must be the maid of honor or the best man. I'll sit at the best spot, because not only did appearance matter, not only does recognition matter, but position matters. Because I need to have the rank, the role, the ratings, the title, the status. And Jesus says, beware of these guys. Beware of these teachers and leaders, because they don't have your best interest at heart. They care only about themselves. Can I just tell you, church, there's teachers and pastors and leaders and bosses that care nothing for you. They care only for themselves, and you need to watch out. You do. Like, don't just assume, don't just take in. Don't assume everybody has your best interest at mind. But Jesus is not just saying, beware of those people. He's saying, be aware, because the ugliness that's in them is the same ugliness that can show up in you. The same seeds of sin that are in them can still show up in you. And worldly greatness feeds this mini celebrity inside of all of us. It feeds this mini celebrity inside of all of us. So beware of the tendencies in your own heart to chase after appearances, recognition, and positions. Psychologist David Elkin coined the phrase imaginary audience. He says this, that there is an audience. Imaginary audience is an audience that is watching our every move, every decision, every post, every word. And we have to live our lives to please and perform for that audience. The secret, though, is, or the trick is, the audience does not exist. That we live thinking there's an audience analyzing our every step, and the reality is nobody's looking at what you're doing. It's known as the spotlight effect, and I think this picture sums up the spotlight effect quite well, that in my mind, everybody's watching me, but in reality, everybody has the spotlight on themselves, right? This is what we tell middle schoolers and high schoolers, that don't worry about what everybody's thinking of you, because they're all worried about what you think of them, right? It's just so true. the audience that we chase is often not real. It's an illusion. And so we get driven by our insecurities to appease an audience that does not exist. Or we get driven by our needy egos trying to impress somebody that, quite frankly, doesn't care and is not even watching. But we feel it. We feel this intense pressure to make our lives a performance that somehow matches up to what we think other people think of us. And our lives become this massive performance, and we feel, some of you feel so anxious and like torn up inside about like making sure I live into the vision of what my dad wants me to live into, or what my coach, or what my boss, or what my peers, what I think they want from me. It's an imaginary audience, and quite honestly, some people chase their whole life after greatness, trying to appease that imaginary audience. And what happens is they get in positions of power, or they get in positions of recognition, or where they're seen by others, and they didn't realize that it's not the joy that they had been hoping for, but actually it's a heavy burden to maintain. It's an incredibly heavy burden to keep putting out and showing why you are so, so great to the world. It's exhausting. It's exhausting. And the ones who do it well, who actually maybe like love God, it's a burden where they have to steward it, because they don't just get to show how great they are. They have to steward it somehow for the glory of God. And these teachers of the law, these were middle-class men. They weren't like huge, well-known celebrities. We don't even know their names, as they're not listed in Scripture. But this mini celebrity was inside of them. It was a spirit of mini celebrity that says, God, I don't need you. I'll earn this on my own. I'm working towards my greatness. I'm going to promote my name, my brand, my vision for what my life can be impressive to others. And that mini celebrity inside of all of us longs to be seen and receive all the glory. And sometimes it shows up in really, really big things, but most of the time it shows up in really, really small things. Let me give you an example. You look around and you go, well, at least I'm a better mom than her. At least I'm a greater mom than her. Or at least I'm a greater student than them. Or at least I'm a better employee or a better boss or whatever it is that we try to compare ourselves with. Jesus goes on and he says, the way this plays out, guys, is it's pretty ugly, not just in them, but it's ugly in our world, is they devour widows' houses. I mean, come on. All right, like that's intense language. Like Jesus is just like, let's say it how it is, that he's using this metaphor. They devour widows' houses, and for a show, make lengthy prayers. These men will be punished most severely. They would rip off widows. A husband would die, and what would happen is these religious leaders would come in. They'd put their arm around the widow. They'd say, can I pray for you? They'd pray for her. They'd be like, oh, man, God loves you, all the things. And do you know, I'm so sorry that you're grieving, and I'm so sorry that Larry is gone, but Larry loved God. Did you know that? Yeah, Larry loved God. And Larry, I think Larry would want to give his kind of money and his wealth to the church. So what if we could rewrite your house? Because they were masters of God's law. And so when they were masters of God's law, they could manipulate God's law for their own personal benefit at the disposal of others. And the celebrity spirituality, this form of it, would take advantage of others for their own personal gain. They would prey on the vulnerable and the weak, and their life would become a show that was all about them and the performance that even affected their prayers, that their prayers were just full of length and language. They were just this performance. They couldn't even get real before God. They were disingenuous and fake. They were hypocrites to the core, speaking against the evil and the pride of Rome, while elitism and superiority and arrogance took residence in their own hearts. These guys were ugly. Worldly greatness, all it is pride in disguise. It's pride in disguise. Can I tell you this? I hate pride. Like, I honestly think pride and arrogance is like the ugliest attribute. Like, this is just me personally. You don't have to think. This is just me. And if you have an inflated ego and I sniff it out, like, we're going to struggle being around each other. I'm just being honest. Like, I struggle with people like that. And I'm pretty good at spotting out pride. Like, I'll see it from a mile away. Like, I take pride in the fact that I can spot out pride. Wait a second, that didn't come out the way I wanted it. Or did it, right? Because honestly, pride's really easy. to see in other people. But it's pretty tough to see in me. It's pretty easy to see it in you, but it's really harder to see it in myself. Pride's sneaky. Pride shows up for me a lot of times when I'm doing the dishes for my wife, and I'm like, my wife has it so good, right? And you're like, really? Like, I'm just doing, I don't know, the basic thing I could do. Pride will show up like me, like, I mean, I'm serving at the church right now. Really hope Pastor Dan walks in right now. Like, that'd be great, you know? Like, hope he sees this, right? You're like, man, what is that? It just shows up. God has a lot to say about pride. He says, I hate pride and arrogance. I hate it. He says, though the Lord is great, he cares for the humble, but he keeps his distance from the proud. Many people spend their whole life trying to win the greatness of the world, and they're opposed and against God. God cannot stand them, and so he keeps his distance from them. You can spend your whole life trying to achieve greatness in our world, and God will be distant from you. The scarier thing is when you can actually achieve it. And pride can so easily fly under the radar of our lives if we're not careful. And so here's what we're going to do. We're going to do three slides of this, okay? This is going to be fun. It's going to hurt a little bit. I'm okay with that. Might be worth taking a picture and reflecting on it later. But three slides of this, we're going to get through it together. Signs of pride in your life or in my life. Looking down on others, refusing to listen to others, not eager to learn because I'm confident that I already know it, finding it hard to admit my wrong because being wrong is a sign of weakness. A sign of pride is finding it hard to clap for the success of others because inside I question if I match up, thinking that they should have asked me to do this. I could do it a whole lot better. More signs of pride is always waiting for the opportunity to highlight myself in a conversation. Assuming that other people's feedback in my life is either wrong, unwarranted, or unnecessary. Doing the things of God without being desperate for the presence of God is a sign of pride. If you serve here, I want you to know that. Not confessing sin unless you're backed into a corner is a sign of pride. Not wanting to talk with someone because you deem them of lesser importance or significance than yourself. Looking at your life as a performance to appear impressive to an imaginary audience, feeling the need to always defend your reputation, your actions, and your name, using others to lift up yourself. Get this, thinking that pride is not a big problem for you is a sign of pride in your life. Might be the biggest. And seeking the attention and approval of other people. You're like, Ethan, that doesn't sound like pride. That sounds like a list of insecurities. And I would tell you this, pride is insecurity that's trying to prove itself. That's all it is. It's insecurity that's trying to prove itself. So when you are in conversations with people, do you try and push your name forward or are you trying to push the name of God forward? Because when I'm in conversations with people, it's easy for me to subtly, sneakily just push my name forward to make myself look a little bit better so they think a little bit greater of me. Rather than pushing the name of God, heaven forbid I push the name of somebody else in front of me to go, man, you should see them. They're great at this. So when I talk to my kids, I'm always the hero of the story. And if you talk to your kids and you're always the hero of the story, like back when I was your age, I used to do this, that, and the other thing, what they will think is that you're the hero and not God. When you talk to your neighbors and your coworkers and your spouse, and you're subtly pushing your name forward, it draws the attention off of God and onto yourself. And James says it this way, if you harbor bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast about it or deny the truth. Such wisdom will come down from heaven, but it is earthly, but does not come down from heaven, but is earthly, worldly, unspiritual, and demonic. For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you can find disorder and every evil practice. When you take the spotlight off of Jesus and place it on yourself, it's demonic. That's what Scripture says. It's demonic. When you try to seek your own glory and lift up your own name, it is satanic because it was Satan who caused the first uprising and mutiny by taking the spotlight off of God and trying to redirect it to himself. C.S. Lewis says this, as long as you are proud, you cannot know God. A proud man is always looking down on thing and people. And of course, as long as you are looking down, you cannot see something or someone that is above you. Am I always looking down? God resists the proud, but shows grace to the humble. So God will do one of two things with your pride. He will either transform it, or he will distance himself from it. I don't know about you, but I don't care to have all the greatness of the world if I have God against me. So I want to desperately choose humility. And Jesus, what he does is he gives this very interesting picture of an unlikely character, and he points to her and he says, that's what real greatness is. Watch what he does. As he's calling out in Mark 12, these prideful and religious teachers, he sits down right afterwards and he starts people watching. You like people watching? Anybody like people watching? Before we had phones, we just people watched. That's what we did. Now we just scroll, right? I was getting my fill of people watching in at a restaurant this past week. I'm like, man, they're really getting after it. I don't even know what they're talking about, but they're heated about this. And I'm like, this is the best time of my life, right? Like, I love people watching. Jesus sits down, decides to go people watching, and he doesn't go to a mall. He doesn't go to the marketplace. He doesn't go to a restaurant. What he decides to do is go to the place of offerings, the treasury. It's an interesting spot to people watch. It's not the spot I would have picked. I think it feels a little intimate, right? But he goes to the court of women is what it was called, or the treasury, where they would have 13 brass boxes around the court where people would come in. So imagine Jerusalem during this time of Passover, people are coming in constantly and they're dropping their coins at the top of that trumpet-like thing, and it would clink all the way down into the brass box that would hold it. Now, I don't have a brass box. I was trying to look for something like that, but we don't have anything around there. So I have a mixing bowl. That'll work. And I was just thinking about this. And Jesus is sitting there, and he's watching these guys, and they're coming in, getting ready to celebrate Passover, and they're emptying their pockets one right after another. Watches one guy do it, sees another guy make his way on up, just empty his pockets. And if you can imagine, I don't know, there's 13 boxes around. So all you're hearing is the conversations of hundreds of thousands of people making their way in, dropping coins into a brass box. And I imagine the disciples are sitting there watching, and they see one guy come up. I don't know if he had a big jar like this or a bag, but he just comes up, and you're like, oh my gosh, did you see how much that guy gave? Like, that's incredible. Do you hear the sound of that? And these guys come in, and they just start making lots and lots and lots of noise, showing how great they are. It's interesting to me. Jesus then calls out this woman who comes impoverished and in rags. She makes her way over. She takes two coins. Two coins. Drops them in. Jesus, knowing what's in everybody's heart in this moment, seeing the proud come in making lots of noise, Jesus sees what's going on in her heart, sees the story. And this widow in rags, who's probably homeless, why do I know that? Because the verse before it says the Pharisees devoured her home, comes in and drops in two coins. Pretty insignificant. Scripture, you might have a translation that says it was two pennies. Two pennies. Nobody jumped for that, right? Like, we discontinued them and nobody even cares. It's insignificant. It's small. It feels kind of worthless. And she throws them in here, and Jesus is like, woo-hoo! Peter, did you catch that? What, the guy with the jar? No, no. Andrew, come over here. Did you see what she just gave? Did you see it? Andrew's like, what? Did you know it's not the riches of this world or the things that you can accomplish or achieve that will turn the head of God? It is radical generosity, extreme trust in God's provision for your life, and humility that will turn his head. Jesus is like, that widow, she needs me. And she's done. She's not making a bunch of noise about how great she is. She just believes that I'm so great that she'll take whatever she has left and throw it in. And what's crazy to me is that what was seemingly small and insignificant, hardly heard on earth, was heard in heaven. Mark 12 continues and says, Jesus said, "Truly I tell you, the poor widow has put more into the treasury than all the others. They gave out of their wealth, but she, out of her poverty, put in everything." She put in everything, all, in case she didn't get it, all that she had to live on. Real greatness is humility that goes all in on God. That's what greatness is. It's real humility that goes all in on God. And this poor widow went all in, and Jesus takes the time to notice her and to celebrate her. Everybody else gave out of their riches and their margins. She gave out of her life savings. And this is not necessarily the point of the story, but I felt like you've been on my brain all week long. If you're a widow in here, I just want you to know that God is not done with you. And he sees you. And you might be feeling like you're coming in with the rags of your past, maybe your history or your old life or the loneliness that you feel, and you're carrying that and kind of making your way on in. And you might feel like you ain't got a lot to give. But Jesus would look at us as a church and go, "Whoa, whoa, whoa. We got a lesson to learn right there. He is not done with you, so please don't write yourself off yet. If you're still on this planet breathing here, God hears every prayer you pray, every small gift you give, every offering, every sacrifice that you don't think will make a big difference. God is going, the halls of heaven hear you, and I'm not done with you." What's crazy to me, what's absolutely wild, is this widow gave two coins. She gives two coins. Who's she give it to? Primarily God, but it's in the temple. Like, she has such a huge view of the sovereignty of God in her life that she's willing to give two of her coins, her life savings, to a temple that stole her house. Because she believes that God, even in a corrupt system, can use it for good. Like, she doesn't believe in the Pharisees. She doesn't trust us. She trusts the sovereignty of God in her life. That's incredible to me. Peter Kreef says this: "If we come to God with empty hands, he will fill them. But if we come with full hands, he will find no place to put himself." The rich young ruler last week had it all, chasing after his own greatness, was holding on to everything that he had, and he walked away sad from Jesus because he had no room for God in his life. The Pharisees, polished exterior lives, held on to their greatness and their temple and their riches, and they're taking advantage of people. And they walked away from Jesus outraged and angry because they had no room for God in their lives. And if you come in with an elite and prideful, arrogant, seeking your own glory and your own greatness with your hands full of that, there will be no room for God in your life. But if you come in with empty hands and open, ready to receive them, going, "God, I'm going all in on you," I think God loves it. I think he loves when people do that. I think he's like, "Woo! Angels, you catch what they just did? Nobody else saw it, but I saw it." Heaven's head turned, and Jesus, I think what he realizes and what you and I need to see is that his sovereignty will tell a better story in the end of things. She didn't have the chance to see it. We don't know anything else about this widow. It just kind of goes off. But God is writing an incredible, better story. But there's one couple other things I want you to see. Real greatness is usually unseen sacrifice that seemingly goes unheard. Seemingly goes unheard. As I was reading this, I was reminded of the fable of the chicken and the pig. The chicken looks to the pig and says, "Pig, we should go into business together." The pig thinks for a moment to himself, says, "Sure, why not? What kind of business do you want to go into?" Chicken looks at him, thinks for a moment, says, "Why don't we go into the bacon and eggs business?" We'll wait for everybody to get there. The pig goes, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, whoa. For you, it's a contribution. For me, it's a sacrifice. It's everything." The rich came in. They just kind of gave out of their margins, something they'd never miss. for this woman, it was everything she had. Worldly greatness will be measured in the gains that we have, in the margins that we have, in the bank account, in the comfortable lifestyle. But heaven doesn't measure greatness that way. Heaven measures greatness by the sacrifice. It's not how much do we get to keep. It's how much do I get to give. That greatness in the kingdom of God is not measured by the sum of what you keep or what you give or what you achieve or what you don't. It is measured by the sum of the sacrifice that you are offering to God. So I don't know what it is for you, but what's your two pennies? What's your life savings? What is it that you need to go all in on for God and go, God, I'm trusting that you're going to work in this, in the sacrifice of this for me. I'm trusting in the sovereignty that you're writing a better story. And I don't know about you, but I struggle with this vision of greatness because it looks like to me in our world today, it's the arrogant who get ahead, the prideful who win, and I just kind of keep getting left behind in the dust. And I can throw myself a pity party about it because I'm like, look at all of them, Lord. They don't love you. They don't seek you. And they're getting ahead. They're winning. And I'm so glad that the disciples struggled with this too. They struggled a lot. Because I struggle a lot with it, and they struggle a lot with it. Jesus in Mark 9 and 10, he's cast out this pretty wicked demon from this wicked, like, impure spirit from this boy that the disciples couldn't do. And they're like, Jesus, that was incredible. How in the world did you do that? That was amazing, Jesus. And then they start walking on the road, and they start getting in a conversation with each other. And Jesus asks them a question. He says this. He says, what were you guys arguing about on the road? But they kept quiet because on the way, they had argued about who was the greatest. They argued about that. After seeing Jesus amazingly, greatly cast out a demon, you don't see that every day, they get squabbling about their greatness. And I don't know, I can picture it. Can you picture it? Like, Peter, guys, come on. I mean, I walked on water, right? Like, none of you guys even got out of the boat. I know I tripped, But come on, no contest. I wonder if John was sitting there like, guys, come on. Just kind of with a smug look on his face, like, I'm the one Jesus loves. I'm like, okay, John. James is like, I'm a son of thunder. Ah, thunder, right? Like, you know, come on. You know it wasn't Bartholomew because you didn't even know that was a disciple until right now, right? Disciples get confused with Jesus and his vision for greatness because their vision for greatness was very different than Jesus' vision for greatness. And they thought, Jesus, you are supposed to make me great in a worldly sense. That if I get a little bit of Jesus in my life, I'm supposed to be seen, recognized, achieve, win in life, get rich and become great and accomplished and successful. I thought that's what you had for me, Jesus. And can I tell you, that's a prevalent teaching in the church today. And I just want to be honest with you. God does not care and does not come to make your life great. He doesn't. He never promised that. In fact, your chasing after greatness is offensive to him. He hates it. He gets frustrated by it. Your arrogance is hard for him to swallow. And the reality is, God knows something that all of us know on the inside, but we don't want to care to admit it, is you're not all that great. Neither am I. We aren't. But guess what? We have a really, really great God. Such a great God that he'll allow us to squabble for a little while on a journey. They're on the road squabbling about their greatness. And God's like, oh, did you figure out who's the greatest? It's like, you know, I made the ocean that you walked on, right? Like, come on, man. And God, Jesus, so gracious with them, is just trying to get them to see something I think is so key. If we stopped being amazed at the greatness of our God, what you will do with the rest of your life is you will argue for your own greatness here in front of others. If you are not amazed at the greatness of our God, you will spend your life arguing for your own greatness, trying to win the approval of the world. And Jesus, he then takes a child whom he placed among them, and taking this child in his arms, he said to them, whoever welcomes one of these little children in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me does not welcome me, but the one who sent me. Jesus is like, you guys talking about greatness? You want to talk about that for a minute? Let's talk about it. It's like a little kid. That's what greatness is like. It's like a little kid. As Garrett and the team make their way out, I want you to see this, that real greatness is a child secure in God's love for them. It's a child secure in the love of God for them. Can I just tell you something amazing to me about kids? Kids have zero agenda for greatness in their life. Have you noticed this? Like, my kid will eat his own boogers. Oh, come on, come on. Right? Like, no agenda for greatness. I don't know why that kid. You're the only service that got that, just so you know. But I don't know a kid that goes, I want to cut the weight, have a 5-step plan to get rich, impress other people in my life. A kid's life is simply this: eat, play, sleep, eat, play, sleep, eat, play, play some more, eat, sleep. Jesus is like, that's great. A kid who has nothing to offer, nothing to give. And I was just struck at amazement this week, as it was a beautiful week at the beginning, and then it got crazy at the end. But at the beginning, I went out with my kids just at the park, and we're playing at the park, and I'm watching them, and they make instant best friend with these two older boys. They're like 7 and 10, these brothers. And they're just instantly, like, they had been friends for their entire lives. I'm like, how did you do that? I'm not that good at making friends. Like, it's incredible. And I wonder if my kids are so great at making friends and other kids are really great at making friends because there's zero ego. There's no agenda to prove to you how great I am. They haven't even thought about that yet. But somewhere along the way, when we grow up, we get really concerned about how others think of us and how great we can become. Aristotle said this. He said, when people don't feel loved, they seek to be admired. Seek to be admired. And I think many of us, what we do is we walk around with an orphan spirit. You know what I mean? Like God says that you are adopted. When you say yes to Jesus, you're adopted into the family of God, that you are God's child, that he loves you. He delights in you. Like, he loves to, like, be with you. But I think many of us, we've forgotten it in some sense or way, or never even knew that God, like, loves us in that way. So we walk around with this orphaned spirit that seeks to win acceptance, to prove our greatness, to show how worth it I am to you, because I need you to admire me, because I'm scared that if you don't admire me, you won't love me. And we don't know where else to get love, so we walk around obsessed, trying to win the approval of others with an orphan spirit. But a child who is secure is attached to the love of God in their life. They know that they are beloved by him. They know that God delights in them. And can I tell you, I can live with an orphan spirit all the time. I really can. Like, I'm obsessed with being great. I want to be a great husband. I want to be a great dad. I want to be a great leader. I want to be a great friend. I want to be a great preacher. I want to be a great coworker. I want to be a great pastor. And I so badly want to be preaching a great sermon right now. And I want to live a great life. But I'm fighting to remember, even right now in my own mind, that when I lay down tonight and my head hits the pillow, what you think of me does not matter. Not in the slightest. What the world thinks of me doesn't matter. The only thing that matters, and the only person who thinks of me that matters, is Jesus Christ. Like, what he thinks of me matters the most in my life. And so when I start to tune into the voice of heaven, start to realize that there's not this, like, prove to me how great you are, Ethan, but just a smile from heaven pointed in my direction that says, I love you as my child. When I walk knowing that, I don't need to live for the approval of the world, and I can actually be free to serve and to love and to then help the world. It was Mother Teresa who said this: not all of us can do great things, but we can do small things with great love. Don't make your life, if I could just charge you and beg you and plead with you, don't make your life about how great you can be. How lame. How lame. You're not that great. Neither am I. It's such a stupid vision for your life. If you think about it. And quite honestly, what an exhausting one. But I want to live my life knowing the one who is the greatest and telling the world of how great he is. His name is Jesus, the one who was rich, who became poor, the one who does not climb to the top but chose to come down, who was born in a manger with no fancy home, no car, no human authority or position of power, who worked as a carpenter most of his life in obscurity with no recognition, no significant people were close to him, but his close circle was fishermen and tax collectors and average Joes and common folk with no wealth. He didn't travel the world. He rode as a king into Jerusalem, not on a white stag promoting his glory, but on a borrowed donkey that he didn't even own. He was left alone for dead, hanging on a cross at the end of his life. And this God-man, who has never demanded the spotlight or attention on himself, was crucified among two criminals, mocked by the world, humiliated, the shame. And yet it is the cross that is now the spotlight that points to the hope and the salvation for the world. As we close, I want to do something different, but I have to ask you a question. Are you living your life like a Roman leader with an orphan spirit, trying to prove to the world how great you are? Are you tired of that? Are you exhausted? Why don't you say yes to Jesus? He's got a totally different vision of what greatness is. It's beautiful. He's the greatest one. Maybe for you, it's not that. It's you're like the religious Pharisees, and your vision for greatness is by making sure that we all think you're impressive. By the way, we don't, because we're too concerned with what we think you think of us. But you're living with an orphan spirit around here, and you're trying to win the approval of us in here, and I just want to remind you, it's Jesus. Like, it's just Jesus. He's the one who loves you, who cares for you, who's the greatest one among us. And you can live your life in a different kind of greatness, looking like a poor widow who makes sacrifices because she's known and loved by her Creator in such a way that she's willing to offer her life to serve others, to do really small, insignificant, but great things done with great love. I want to invite you to do this. I want to invite you to stand because I want to read this and pray this kind of over us in Philippians 2 as we close. And then I just want us to respond and worship the greatness of our God together. Philippians 2 says this, "Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking for your own interests, but each of you to the interests of others. In your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who being in the very nature God, did not consider it equality with God, something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking on the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross." Let's respond by how great our God is.